Harper Audio presents Tom Clancy's NetForce number 4, Breaking Point. Created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik. Performed by Stephen Lang. Wednesday, June 1st, 2011. Daru, China. The sun rose from the gray sea and cast a fitful light upon the wrinkled features of old Zhang, where he sat on the weathered bench outside the house, leaning forward slightly on his cane. He was often up with the sun these days to enjoy the dawn, knowing he would not have so many more. But instead of making him sad, the thought made him angry. This day seemed somehow sharper than normal. His clouded sight was clearer, his hearing keener than usual. Old Zhang had but recently moved to the village of Daru, a mere dozen years or so ago, a blink of an eye for a man his age, forced to leave his real home, which was flooded by the monstrous dam project that forever altered the face of China's rivers. At 94, he had outlived his wife, several of his children, and even a few of his grandchildren, and he did not like it here, staying with one of the grandchildren he had not outlived. Oh, his room was comfortable enough, but the village was a mudhole of a place. On the mainland across the stormy Formosa Strait from Taiwan, on the coast just north of Quanzhou, Daru was peopled with many elderly residents, some victims of the cursed dam, such as himself. Save for a few younger souls, fishermen mostly, it was a place of old men and women waiting to die. Thinking about his forced relocation brought Zhang to anger again, and this time the rage seemed to fill him with a hot glow. How dare they do such a thing? The foolish communists, who saw everything in terms of their immoral philosophy, had ruined the country in but half a lifetime. He had hoped to live long enough to see the children of Mao plowed under, but he was beginning to realize it was not to be. And this angered him even more. He was old, old. He had worked hard all his long life, and what was his reward? To be shunted to a half-wit grandson's home in a mudhole village unfit for pigs? It was not right. Zhang gripped the heavy cane tightly and his rage enveloped. No, it was not right. His sow of a granddaughter, only 34 and already so fat she could hardly waddle, lumbered up the graveled path to stand in front of him, her doughy hands on her massive hips, blocking the sun. She said, "Why are you out here again, Grandfather Zhang? You will catch pneumonia. I would be happy if you did and died, but Min Yang would be distressed and I will not have it. Get up and go inside right now." The sow seemed fairly angry herself, which was unlike her. Usually she was merely torpid, dense as a post and twice as stupid, Zhang reflected, and the best his idiot grandson Ming could do for himself. A shame. "You are blocking the sun," Zhang said. "Stand aside." "Are you grown deaf as well as stupid, you ancient fart-maker? I said get up." And with that she reached out, as if to grab him and physically drag him into the house. This was a mistake. With a speed and strength that surprised him, Zhang snapped the cane up and jabbed it into the sow's belly. "Oof!" she said as she leaned forward, grabbing at her stomach. Zhang stood, pulled the cane back as if it were an axe, and delivered a mighty blow to the side of her head. The bone made a wet but satisfying crack, and the sow went down in a heap. "Ha-ha!" Zhang leaned over and smashed the cane into the sow's body with all the strength he possessed. Ah, this was good. He hit her again, better, and again, better still. He was not the man he had been, but there were still a few moves left in him, and the sense of rage he felt continued to burn as he beat upon the prostrate and unresponsive sow. He grew tired after a while and decided to rest before resuming his chore. As he stood there contemplating the sow, he chanced to look up, and thus saw his idiot grandson charging toward him, a three-tined pitchfork in hand. Amazing, since his grandson was the meekest of men. "Old fool, I will kill you," Ming Yang screamed. Old Zhang smiled wolfishly. "Yes? Come and try, wiper of asses." He raised his cane to meet the charge. Zhang was paying attention to how he planned to dance around the fork's tines to strike Ming, but even so, with his heightened senses, He was aware of his great-grandson Cheng, aged 13, rushing up behind his father, a gleaming fish gaff lifted over his head. Now, who was Cheng planning to skewer? Well, it did not matter, did it? Zhang would deal with him in due course, just as he would deal with every other person in this mudhole of a village. He would kill them all. Finally, a happy thought. He laughed aloud. Thursday, June 2nd, Quantico, Virginia. Alex Michaels pedaled his recumbent trike along the wide bike path between Net Force HQ and the Chinese restaurant where he sometimes had lunch, pumping hard. The day was hot and muggy, despite a cloudy overcast. He shifted up another gear as he zipped past a trio of Marine officers from the base, jogging along at a pretty good clip themselves. Ordinarily, he enjoyed riding the trike, feeling the burn in his legs and lungs, knowing he was working his muscles and cooking off that half-carton of Haagen-Dazs he'd eaten the night before. Ordinarily, the commander of Net Force enjoyed a lot of things, but like his feet toe clipped into the pedals, a lot of what he had been doing lately had been no more than going through the motions. Work was pretty good. Aside from the 10,000 usual small fish Net Force had to school and round up, there weren't any major problems in the world of computer crime just at the moment. Nothing like the mad Russian who'd wanted to take over the planet, or the senator's aide who wanted to buy up the world bit by bit, or even the dotty English lord who'd wanted to bring back the glory days of the Empire. Congress hadn't cut him off at the knees lately, and his boss, the new FBI director, was sometimes hard-headed, but basically not too bad, and she mostly left him alone. Work was fine. It was his personal life that was an absolute wreck. His ex-wife Megan had gotten engaged and was petitioning the courts in Idaho for sole custody of their daughter Susie. Her new love wanted to adopt the girl. Susie liked her mom's new friend, which was more than Michaels could say. That he had decked the man at a family Christmas gathering had not helped the situation any, even though it had felt pretty good at the time. Michaels could fight it. His lawyer said he had a pretty good chance of winning in court, and Michael's knee-jerk reaction at first had been to do just that, fight it until his last breath, if need be. But he loved his daughter, and she was at a tender age, still years away from being a teenager. What would a nasty court battle do to her? The last thing he wanted to do was traumatize his only child. Would it be better for her to have a mother and father, even a stepfather, there with her all the time? Washington, D.C. was a long way from Boise, and Michaels didn't see his daughter as much as he wished. Had shuffling out to see him in the summers done some kind of irreparable harm to Susie? Would it make her life worse in the long run? The big banked curve on the bike trail was just ahead, and rather than slow down, Michaels decided he was going to power his way through it. He upshifted and pumped even harder, but as he started into the curve, he saw a group of walkers ahead, residents of a local nursing home. He stopped pedaling and squeezed the handbrakes. The heavy-duty disc brakes on all three wheels squeaked from the sudden pressure, and then came almost to a stop. None of the geriatric crowd even noticed him until he crept around them at walking speed. That would have been all he needed, to plow into Grandma and Granddaddy on his trike at full tilt, one more brick on the load. And of course, there was the big problem in his life, Tony. She was still in England, practicing Penjat Silat, the Indonesian martial art in which she was an adept, studying with that Carl somebody. There hadn't been anything personal between Carl and Tony when Michaels had left the UK, but who knew about now? It had been more than a month. A lot could happen in a month. Tony Fiorella was smart, beautiful, and could kill you with her hands if she felt so inclined. She'd been his deputy commander until she'd quit. And she'd been his lover, until she'd found out about his indiscretion with the blonde MI6 agent, Angela Cooper. Near indiscretion, Alex, his little voice said. We didn't actually do anything, remember? Yeah, we did. It never should have gotten to the point where I even thought about it. We were tired, half drunk, and Cooper was working at it, the massage and all. No excuse. It was an argument he'd had with himself 1,000 times in the last 6 weeks, with 1,000 variations. If only Tony hadn't gone to France. If only he hadn't agreed to a beer and fish and chips with Angela. If. It was all pointless speculation now, and he couldn't lie to himself about it no matter how much he wished it. He thought about bringing the trike back up to speed, but it suddenly didn't seem worth the effort. The Chinese place was not that far away. It wasn't as if he was in any kind of hurry now, was it? Or was hungry, or gave a rat's ass about getting back to work on time. He blew out a sigh. You sure are a sorry, self-pitying bastard, aren't you? Snap out of it. Suck it up. Be a man. Fuck you, he told his inner voice. But that part of him was right. He wasn't a sensitive, new-age kind of guy. In his world, men took care of business and soldiered on. That was the way his father had taught him. You screwed up, then you took the heat, and you got on with your life. Period. What was that old saying? You can't do the time, don't do the crime. That was pretty much it. In theory, anyway. Sperryville, Virginia. Ow! Jay Gridley said. He slapped at his bare arm, and when he pulled his hand away, there was the crushed body of a mosquito. At least he thought it was a mosquito. It was hard to tell. Murderer, Saji said. She smiled. Self-defense, he said. If I'd known I was going to be attacked by all these itty-bitty vampires, I'd have thought twice about going for a walk in the woods with you. This would be so much more pleasant in VR. My father used to say that God made two mistakes, mosquitoes and teamsters. Of course, he was the president of his local, so he could say that. But he was wrong. Both mosquitoes and teamsters have their places. Jay shook his head. Sounds like more Buddhistic smoke and mirrors to me. You gotta go some to justify mosquitoes.
Really? Tell that to the bats who eat them.
They could eat something else. Plenty of bugs that don't bite people. They could double up on gnats or something.
Come on, Jay. If you take away everything that causes you discomfort, there's no way to measure your pleasure.
They were on a narrow dirt trail that wound through a section of mostly hardwood forest. There was enough shade so the day's heat didn't lay too heavy a hand on them, and the air was rich in the smells of warm summer vegetation. The backpack was a lot heavier than anything Jay was used to carrying, but since Saji's was every bit as heavy, he could hardly complain. He had the tent, but she had the cooking gear. He shook his head. He couldn't successfully argue philosophy or religion with Sojan Rinpoche. She could talk circles around him. Though only in her 20s, she was much more educated in such things than he was. They had met after the online injury he'd got stalking the creator of a quantum computer that had caused NetForce all kinds of problems. Since they'd come together initially in VR, virtual reality, via the Internet, they had been in persona, and hers had been that of an aged Tibetan monk. She was a lot better looking as a young woman than she had been as an old man, and she had been instrumental in helping him recover from a brain injury that theoretically wasn't even possible.
See, that's the problem with you, Jay. You spend too much time online. You need to get out more.
I could put mosquitoes in a scenario if I wanted.
You could, but have you ever?
Well, no.
And without experiencing real bugs sucking your blood and going splat when you slap them, you wouldn't be able to do it accurately, and even then it would only be an imitation and not the real thing.
But isn't this all just an illusion? He waved one hand to encompass the wooded hillside.
Wrong religion, white boy. Try the Hindus or the existentialists. Buddhists aren't into denying reality. We like to get down and roll around in it.
What about that old man persona of yours on the net?
A tool, that's all. Got me past a lot of preconceptions. Besides, an illusion is by definition not real, so altering it one way or the other doesn't make it any more or less real, now does it?
He chuckled. Boy, he liked being with her. So how much farther is it to this secret place of yours?
Couple more miles.
He gave a theatrical groan. You didn't tell me I was going to have to hike halfway around the planet carrying a house on my back. This better be worth the walk.
Oh, it will be. Guaranteed satisfaction or your money back.
Well, that sounded promising. He slapped at another mosquito, and was inclined to agree with Saji's father on at least one point, despite what she'd said. When John Howard walked into the range, he heard, "Tan-tut! General in the house! Morning, Brigadier!" Howard fought the grin, but lost.
Amid the familiar tang of burned gunpowder, Sergeant Julio Fernandez stood at ramrod attention, a perfect salute in place. Any crisper, and he would have crinkled.
No such thing as a brigadier anymore, you know that.
It has a nice ring, sir.
At ease, Lieutenant, Howard said. He returned the salute.
Not funny, John.
Hey, I can do it, you know, me being a general now instead of a colonel. What do you think, Gunny?
Behind Julio, the range master grinned at the handsome black general.
Oh, yes, sir. I believe Sergeant Fernandez is excellent officer material, sir. Never has earned his money.
I get promoted. First thing I'll do is fire your sorry ass, Fernandez said. You'll be out whitewashing rocks on the parade ground 18 hours a day.
Gunny laughed. Long arms or sidearms today, sir?
Howard said,
I believe the sergeant needs a lesson in how to shoot his pistol.
Gunny nodded and set two plastic boxes of ammo on the counter. The blue box contained 357 cartridges, the orange box 9mm. Howard grabbed the blue box, Fernandez the orange.
Lanes 8 and 9, the rangemaster said.
Howard put his earplugs in as he headed for the entrance to the gallery, Fernandez hurrying to beat him to the door so he could hold it open.
Let me, General. I wouldn't want you complaining you hurt your hand or anything after I shoot the pants off of you. I never got to beat a general before. And not likely you'll start today, Sergeant.
In their respective lanes, the two Net Force military men set their ammo down and started up the holo projectors. They used identical scenarios when they went for scores against each other, so there would be no doubt who had outshot whom. Howard slipped the fist paddle holster with his Smith & Wesson 357 Model 66 revolver nestled in it into his waistband and adjusted things. The S&W was an antique, stainless steel, and not nearly as efficient as the polymer tactical pistols Net Force issued. The H&Ks and the Walthers carried almost 3 times as much ammo, and had all kinds of bells and whistles, lasers, suppressors, flashlights, all very modular. Until recently, the Smith had been pretty much stock, unmodified. Howard had allowed Gunny to talk him into trying a red dot scope, a tiny one that mounted where the iron sights were, which had improved his shooting immediately.
Even so, it felt like sacrilege. The old wheel gun was as much talisman as anything, his good luck piece, and in the same category as the Tommy gun he had gotten from his grandfather. It worked, but it couldn't really run with the newer hardware out there, even with the Tasco scope.
Julio was still smiling every time he saw the scope, too.
You ready, John? Crank it up.
Fernandez was using his blued Beretta Model 92, not as ancient as the Smith, but certainly not in the same class as the tactical pistols either. Two old and grizzled types they were, set in their ways. If they weren't careful, the future was going to blow right past them. The mugger, armed with a crowbar, materialized 30 feet away and ran toward Howard. He snatched his piece out of the holster, brought it up, and did a fast double tap, aiming at the chest. The mugger stopped and fell down. The holographics on the range were pretty good, and the computer registered the hits and kept track of everything.
Got me by a quarter second, Fernandez said from the other side of the bullet-resistant barrier. General's luck.
Right, Howard said.
Rack 'em up, and I'll show you how lucky I really am.
The second mugger had a long knife, and Howard's first round caught him a hair high just at the base of the throat. Good enough, since the second round didn't go off. Instead, there was a metallic pop, and the cylinder jammed.
Got a mechanical malfunction here, Howard yelled.
He kept the weapon pointed downrange, waiting. Julio came around the barrier, an eyebrow raised in question.
Something broke. Cylinder won't turn. I'll get Gunny out here to take a look. So much for your six-for-sure theory.
The rangemaster said, Sorry, sir, but sooner or later everything wears out. I can fix it, but it's going to take a few days to get the parts.
General will need a loaner. Why don't you show him the Medusa?
Gunny smiled and went to the gun safe. He came back with a styrofoam box. On top of it was a little pamphlet. Howard flipped it open to the first page and saw, Firearms are dangerous weapons, in bold print at the top of the page.
He shook his head. That's what came of too many lawyers without enough to do. A maker had to warn you that a gun was dangerous. What was the duh factor there?
Gunny opened the box. Inside was a flat black revolver with what looked like ivory grips. It seemed like a K-frame S&W with a funny-looking squared-off and grooved barrel. Fernandez took the revolver from the rangemaster.
General, this here is a PNR Model 47, a.k.a. Medusa. Got a neat little red fiber optic front sight and fully adjustable rear sight, coated with black Teflon so it won't rust.
He handed the piece to Howard. It felt good, familiar, if it looked a little squarish for his tastes.
You getting a commission from these people, Julio? And why would I like this more than my Smith?
Fernandez grinned.
Well, sir, if we can get you to use a semi-auto, at least we can get you closer to the current century. These first came out in 1996, and they have a big advantage over your antique Smith. They will chamber and fire everything from an anemic 380 ACP to the hottest 357 Magnum rounds. You can load it up with any variation of 9mm you can think of. Bunch of other calibers will work, too, but the manufacturer doesn't recommend them.
And how many cylinder changes do I have to carry to accomplish this miracle? Three? Five?
No, sir. Not a one. Pop the cylinder and push back on the extractor rod.
Howard did so.
Those are springs, those little things in the chambers. Anything that'll fit, they'll hold in place, and it'll cook 'em off just fine. You happen to find yourself on a battlefield somewhere and you run out of 357. You can always find 9mm somewhere, it still being the most popular military caliber worldwide.
Howard looked at the gun.
What's the catch? Well, sir, there are three. It doesn't much like speed loaders because of the springs. Speed strips would be. Second, if you're going to mix calibers, you should shoot the longer stuff first so as not to gunk up the chambers. And third, if you are mixing calibers, the sights won't be dead on for the different ones, so you have to adjust the rear sights. But most of the time, you'll be shooting the same ammo. At close range, you don't need to worry about the sights anyhow.
Julio nodded at the Medusa.
Why don't you put a few through as long as we're here? Unless you want to, forfeit the match.
You wish.
Gunny said, let me see your ring, sir.
Howard nodded and slipped the Net-Force signet ring from his right third finger. It looked ordinary enough, but inside the mounting was a tiny computer chip. As of a month ago, all Net-Force carry and field-issue sidearms, subguns, and rifles were now equipped with smart technology. The guns had an internal chip that kept the actions from operating unless they received a coded signal. The ring sent the signal and had a range of a few centimeters, no more. The Net-Force guns were all tuned to the same signal, so, if needed, they could shoot each other's weapons. But if anybody not wearing the transmitting signet ring tried to fire a Net-Force small arm, it would simply refuse to go off. Howard was not happy with the things, but there was no choice in accepting them. All federal agencies would eventually be using smart guns, and the FBI was taking the lead. So far, the new guns had operated at 100% no failures. So far. Gunny put the ring into a slot on the coder and checked the program, then did the same for the new gun.
All set, sir.
He passed the ring and revolver back to Howard. Howard looked at the gun as he slipped the ring back on. The theory was fine. If your kid found your weapon, at least he wouldn't shoot himself or one of the neighbors. It wasn't foolproof. Somebody could snatch one of the rings and use it. But it was supposed to keep Net-Force people from being shot if they lost a gun in the heat of battle. And once a month, you were to run your ring through a coder that reset the command signal, so any lost rings would no longer work after 30 days. Back at the lane, Howard loaded the revolver using his .357 ammo. He set a stationary bullseye at 15 meters, lined the sights up. The front sight had a red dot on it. He squeezed off a round. He was surprised. Even though it fired the same cartridge, the recoil seemed considerably less than the Smith. He looked at the counter, a centimeter below dead center. He cooked off the rest of the cylinder and managed a grouping that went maybe 4 or 5 centimeters, all in the X-ring. Damn, this was great for a gun he'd never fired before. Hell, it was great for a gun he'd been shooting for years.
Not bad for an old guy, Julio said. Want to get back to it?
He waved at the target.
You and the Beretta you sleep with against the gun I've just picked up?
Right.
Tell you what, to make it fair, I'll go and borrow that snub 38 special gun he has. $10 says I can beat you with that.
If you are determined to give up your money, Sergeant, I will take it.
Fernandez grinned.
Be right back.
London, England. Tony Fiorello deflected Carl Stewart's right punch to her throat, with her own strike at his face.
Carl switched tactics, twisted, went with her move, looped his parried hand across her chest, and stepped in for a throw behind her leg, the kenjit. Tony dropped her weight, knees bent deeply, leaned forward and reversed the move, snapped her own foot back, caught his leg for a biset takedown. Carl leaned in, put his head on her shoulder, stole her base and switched feet fast and did the inside sweep, sapu dalam. She wasn't quick enough with the counter and she went down, dived and tried to make it into a roll, but he was there tapping her on the floating ribs with the heel of his wrestling shoe, just hard enough to let her know he had the shot. Tony grinned, took his offered hand and got back to her feet. The entire sequence had taken maybe 3 seconds.
"Good series," he said.
"Yes."
They were alone in the school where he taught his classes, a version of the Indonesian martial art of Pencaksilat that was similar to her own system. Tony had been training since the age of 13. She knew the 8 jurus of the entry-level style called Bukti Negara, plus the 18 jurus of the more complex parent art, Sirak, and until she had met Carl Stewart, had never sparred with anybody who could beat her. Well, except for her teacher, Guru De Beers. Guru was in her 80s now, still shaped like a brick and dangerous to anybody who might be stupid enough to think she was a helpless old lady. But if push came to shove, Tony knew she could best her teacher in a fight. Barely. That was the thing about Silat. It didn't depend on strength or speed, but more on principles. In theory, a player always expected to go up against bigger, stronger, and multiple opponents who were probably armed. Being able to survive and even prevail under such circumstances meant your technique had to be very good, and your system absolutely scientific. Carl glanced at the wall clock. "Got an hour before the beginning class gets here. You want to get a cup of tea or coffee?" Tony hesitated a second, then said, "Sure." There was no reason not to. Alex was back in Washington, and she was still not happy with him. She had programmed her comm to bounce his calls, though he still tried to get through at least once every day. They were officially broken up, and she didn't work for NetForce anymore. She had enough money to stay in London through the summer. Then she was going to have to find a job, and that would have to be back in the U.S. Meanwhile, she was learning a lot from Carl. He was a good 20 years older than she was, but there was an attraction that went beyond martial arts, too. He was good-looking, and, she had found out by accident, rich. So far, she hadn't pursued a relationship. So far. It was tempting. Alex had done so with Angela Cooper, the MI6 operative they had worked with on the Goswell operation, and Tony was still very much pissed off at him for that. The thing was, as angry as she was at Alex, she still loved him. It was kind of hard to get around that, loving him. Still, Carl was here.
Quantico, Virginia. Howard had to admit that he was doing better than he usually did with the Smith, and for a new gun, that was fairly amazing. Even so, Julio was beating him, just barely, and using a snub-nosed chief special he had never shot before. That ought to be impossible. After the last go-round, Howard put the Medusa down.
"Sergeant Fernandez, bring that little revolver here. I want to take a look at it." "God hates a sore loser, John."
"Let me see it." Fernandez came around the barrier, holding the .38 special snubby on his palm. Howard looked at the weapon. Stainless steel, 2-inch barrel, plain ramp and notch sight, non-adjustable. The chief was basically a smaller version of his revolver, a J-frame to his K-frame. In the hands of an expert, this gun could certainly put the bullets on target, but the short barrel and minimal sights made such a thing difficult on a good day without a lot of practice. Julio shouldn't be able to do it right out of the box.
"Satisfied?"
He started to pull his hand away. Howard grabbed the revolver and turned it over. When he did, he noticed the small button on the inside of the grip under his middle finger.
"And just what is this?"
He pointed the gun downrange and squeezed the grips. 100 meters away, a bright red spot appeared all the way out on the back wall. There was a laser built into the grips.
"You cheating bastard. You set me up."
Julio laughed.
"Gunny showed it to me before you got here. It's from somebody called Crimson Trace. Cool, ain't it?"
You adjust it with a tiny little Allen wrench right there and up there, and unlike a dot scope, you don't even have to bring the weapon up to eye level. You can hip shoot. They make them for K-frames, too, so you could get them for the Medusa or the Smith.
You work for these people, too, Julio?
Julio laughed again and pointed at the dancing dot.
Old guys like us. We need some advantages. Ghani says they make these for a whole bunch of guns, including my Beretta.
I'm gonna get one before Joanna has our kid, and we have to start putting away every penny for his college education.
God hates a cheater more than he does a sore loser. No second-place winner in a gunfight, John. You know that. What do you think about the Medusa?
I can force myself to use it until Gunny gets the Smith back online.
Julio gave him a knowing grin.
Ah, I see.
Howard grinned.
Okay. So it's a great piece. You happy?
You working for these people, John? Getting a commission on sales?
It was Howard's turn to laugh, and he did. Seattle, Washington. Sitting in his Dodge Caravan, Patrick Morrison rode the ferry from Seattle toward Bainbridge Island. This was the first leg of a journey that would involve driving north after the boat ride, another ferry, then another short stint in the car, to finally arrive back at Port Townsend. The picturesque little town on the little peninsula where the Straits of Juan de Fuca turn south into Puget Sound was only about 40 miles away from downtown Seattle as the crow flew, but a two-hour trip by car and boat, if you were lucky enough to make the ferry connections just right. Morrison owned a house on the hill in Port Townsend, where Shannon, his bride of 4 months, was doubtless still in bed asleep at this hour. She was 25, gorgeous, a trophy wife half his age. Shannon was his second marriage, the first one having gone bad after almost 20 years. Marion had also been beautiful when he'd met her, and brilliant, which he'd always thought was the bigger attraction. But she'd let herself go, had gotten fat and lazy, and, it turned out, had been too smart, especially with her mouth. He liked intelligent women, but he found that he liked them at a distance. Too close and they were like fire. You got burned by their brilliance. Shannon, on the other hand, was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. She really wasn't stupid, probably above average intelligence. But Shannon knew tricks with her hands and her body that Morrison had never dreamed of doing in 19 years of marriage to Marion. And her mouth was smart, but in an entirely different way. He shifted a bit, suddenly excited by the idea of being home and in bed with Shannon. Morrison opened the Dodge's door and stepped out. The van was 6 years old, but a Dodge, so it was good for another 10 years if he took care of it. Not that he intended to keep it that long. Pretty soon he'd be able to buy a new car. A fleet of new cars if he wanted, with a ship upon which to transport the fleet and a navy to escort it if he so wished. He smiled at the thought. The air had that salty seaweed tang to it. Gulls flew past. It was a great morning. Of course it was a great morning. The test had gone so well he couldn't believe it. The Chinese had clamped down on it fast, squelching the incident into official silence, so there hadn't been any reports in the media. Morrison had his sources, though, and he found out quickly enough. The tests had replicated the experiments with animals even better than anticipated. It might not work on a battlefield with shifting troops, but the device would definitely work on a permanent settlement. He'd known that it would. Well, to be absolutely honest, he had been almost certain. There was always the worry about field testing versus the lab. One never got over that. It took only a few failures to keep that anxiety alive forever. Failure, unfortunately, had no friends, which was how Dr. Patrick Riley Morrison, with his Ph.D. in physics from MIT, had come to be involved with the project in the first place. He'd had a spectacular failure in his extremely low-frequency experiments involving chimpanzees, and he'd lost his grant and funding big time and damned fast. It was as if he'd developed a sudden case of pneumonic plague, the first sneeze and every professional contact he knew scattered as if they were parts of a bomb, kablam! No rat leaving a sinking ship had ever moved as fast as his grad students and research assistants had bailed on him. He smiled at his own bitterness. Well,
If the ELF Simian protocols hadn't gone south on him, he'd never have gotten the job in Alaska, would he? And look where that had taken him. He could hardly be positioned better, could he? Well, yes, he supposed academically he could be. But if somebody just up and gave you $500 or $600 million, well, that would go a long, long way to assuage one's wounded ego, wouldn't it? People would kill for that kind of funding, and rightly so. With $500 million in his pocket, he could thumb his nose at the journals, take his time to do whatever he damned well pleased, and when he was ready, then they'd come begging, by God, because his theories did work after all, didn't they? True, he didn't want to take credit for it just now, given the mode and manner in which he had finally proved himself correct, but someday it would be his to claim. Perhaps he would hire the Goodyear blimp and have it fly back and forth across the country with lights flashing and blazing it out for all to see. I told you so. He looked at his watch. He would go home, spend the day with Shannon, then catch a plane back to SeaTac for the flight to Washington, D.C. After the second and third tests, the events would surely be public, and it was of primary importance that he be prepared for that. He was one of the sharper knives in the drawer, and he knew that it was not enough to be smart. You had to be clever as well. Smart, clever, a beautiful young wife who thought the sun rose and set in his shadow, and rich. He had it all but the last, and that was coming a mere matter of a few weeks or months. Ha! Life was good, and it was about to get better. Washington, D.C. We're going to Oregon, Tyrone Howard said. He grinned. Nadine Harris, who at 13 was the same age as Tyrone, returned his smile in a larger white-against-chocolate version. Exemplary, Tyrone. Congratulations. They were at the soccer field at their school, where they had gone to practice throwing boomerangs. No, he said. We are going to Oregon. My dad, my mom, me, and you. She blinked at him. What? I asked if you could go. My parents said it was okay. We can both enter the tourney. I might even let you win. She laughed. Let me win? In your dreams, funny boy. Last I looked, my best hang time was 17 seconds better than your best. That was then, honey child. This is now. He waved his backpack. It came? She knew right away what he was talking about. That was one of the things he liked about her. She wasn't the most beautiful girl in the world, but she was athletic, and she was very quick. He nodded, yep, in this morning's mail. Let me see, let me see. He laughed. From inside the backpack, he produced the object in question. A new boomerang. And not just any boomerang, but a Larry Takahashi Kinuha, a silk leaf. A Paxilin MTAL hook identical to the one that Jerry Prince had used to win the maximum time aloft at the Internationals last year. It had cost him $65, and it came pre-tuned and ready to throw. Prince had spiraled his up at the Internationals in Sydney last summer and hung it for 5 minutes and 16 seconds, with a 30-click-per-hour wind blowing. On a calm day, word was he could keep it in the air a whole lot longer, in practice anyway. The boomerang was lightweight, thin and flexible, made from layers of linen and glue, and colored a psychedelic electric blue with a black leaf stenciled on the long arm. Wow, Nadine said. So are you going to come with us? I don't know. My mom planned to have me doing yard work this summer. It's not the whole summer. It's only 3 weeks. My mom said she'd talk to yours. Come on, Nadine, how often are you going to get a chance to enter the Junior Nationals if they aren't here in town? Oh, I'll ask, because I'd love to go. Oregon. My dad is borrowing an RV from somebody he knows. It'll be cheaper than staying in motels and eating out. Dad says we'll take 5 or 6 days to drive out, spend a week there, then a leisurely drive home. We'll get there like 2 days before the JN. Have time to practice. It sounds great. Show me what you got. She waved at the new rang. No, you get to throw it first, he said. Really? No, I couldn't. Yeah, you can. Then I can beat you and make you feel bad. Ha! Gimme it.
He smiled as she took the new boomerang and headed out to where they had chalked a throwing circle. He sure did like her. She wasn't gorgeous like Belladonna Wright, and Nadine didn't make his heart race as Bella had done. But she was somebody he could hang with. Not exactly like a sister, but not somebody who stirred up his hormones too much either. Outside of his pal Jimmy Joe Hatfield, he didn't have any other close friends, and boy, she could throw. He watched her limber up her arm and shoulder, drop some pixie dust to check the wind direction, then set herself for the throw. The new boomerang whirled from her hand and soared, climbed steeply, twirling into the morning sunshine. Man, look at it go. Friday, June 3rd, Quantico, Virginia. As he usually did when things got dicey in his personal life, Alex Michaels buried himself in work, which was why he was at the office at 9 p.m. on a Friday night, keeping busy. He scanned computer files, logged into reports annotated by his staff, and tried not to think about anything else. Somebody was scamming old people by selling phantom retirement property from a website that appeared to be located in some kind of moving vehicle in southern Florida. Another third world country had joined the net, peddling drugs you couldn't buy without a prescription in the U.S., and for a third the cost. Some hacker had broken into the Sears mainframe and was threatening to wipe all the memory clean if they didn't pay him $500,000. It was the usual kind of thing that NetForce handled, and there seemed to be more and more of it coming their way every day. Tony had decided he was serious enough, apparently. So he had already learned the first two from the mother art, and already knew the third one, pretty much. He'd watched Tony enough to pick up the moves, though he didn't tell her that. So he was way ahead of the learning curve here. Probably helped if you were working out every day, not to mention sleeping with the teacher, Michaels thought. Though that wasn't happening anymore. Shit. Let's not even go down this road again, okay? Either work out or get back to the computer, but don't sit here whining. He looked around. Most of his regular crew was gone. Only the night shift was on. Gridley and Howard were on vacation. Seattle, Washington. Luther Ventura sat in the Coffee Me store in the mall near the new entrance to Underground Seattle, holding a triple espresso. The textured cardboard sleeve around the paper cup allowed just enough heat to warm his hands slightly as he inhaled the fragrant vapor wafting up from the fluid. The brew smelled bitter, and it was as dark as a pedophile's sins. He inhaled the scent, connecting to it as a wine expert might enjoy the aroma of a great vintage. When he was ready, Ventura sipped the espresso, let the hot liquid swirl around in his mouth a bit, then swallowed it. Ah. When he drank or ate, that was what he did. He didn't read the paper, he didn't watch television, he didn't split his attention. Well, save for the basic condition orange he always maintained in public. But he had been doing that for so long, it was almost a reflex. After 25 years of practice, you didn't have to think about that consciously. You automatically sat with your back to the wall. You checked the entrances and exits of any building into which you went. You were always aware of what was going on around you. You expanded your consciousness, relied on all your senses, including your hunches, tuned out nothing, but allowed yourself enough quiet that you could experience the total reality of the place where you were. Sanchin, the sword players called it, the zen of being in the moment, no matter where you were and what you were doing, of being and not merely doing. To Ventura's mind, this was all unthinking and basic, absolutely necessary to a man who wanted to stay alive in the business he'd been in. Once upon a time, Luther Ventura had been an assassin, and once upon a time, he had been the best in the business. He had worked for governments, he had worked for corporations, and he had worked freelance. 23 years he had done it. Not any longer. He hadn't assassinated anybody in a while. Oh, he could still run with most of the elite. His skills had been considerable, and they had not deserted him completely. But his time had passed. He wasn't going to lie to himself. Experience could balance many things, but no fighter stayed champion forever. Those who tried to hang on too long always lost. Always. He could still do 20 chins. He could run 5 miles in half an hour, and he could hit any target his weapon was capable of hitting. But he was pushing 50, and his reflexes weren't what they had once been. He wore glasses to read. He could have tried to fool himself into thinking he still had all the moves, but that was the road to hell, sure enough. 3 years ago, he had taken out a Brazilian drug dealer protected by 100 troops and 12 skilled bodyguards. The tap had been extremely difficult, and it had to be perfect in every way. Perfect. Even if your talents never wavered, you couldn't improve on perfection. The best you could ever do was match it. And there was no joy in that. It was not worth the risk. There weren't any old assassins. So he folded his cards and walked away from the game a winner. Sure, he had killed people recently, but those had been defensive. Now he made his money protecting people from other assassins. It was, in many ways, more difficult. There were still challenges to be met. That was his focus, and while it did not have the same level of excitement, it had some advantages. It was legal, it was less risky, and although he didn't need the money, it was lucrative. He put the espresso down, finished. All he needed was the first sip. One sip was enough. It was the essence of the experience. No more was necessary. He looked at his watch. It was 1 minute past 8 a.m. He had a new client, though he was not to start officially working for the man for several days. But as soon as Ventura took on a job, it occupied his attention, and he did what it took to get into the proper mindset. Although he was out of town for a few days, at around 7:30 a.m. on Saturdays, his client usually arrived in Seattle via ferry and came to this coffee shop, where he had a cup of triple espresso. For the next several days, Ventura would walk in his client's shoes, go where he went and do what he did as much as possible. He would get to know the man's routine, just as he had gotten to know the routines of those he had sought out and killed. And when he knew what he needed to know, then he would notice anything that did not belong. He pulled a small phone from the pocket of his gray silk sport coat. He pressed a button on it, then said, "All right, let's move." The rest of his primary team, 2 men and 2 women, were in the coffee shop or covering the street outside. He watched the man and woman pretending to be a married couple stand and walk arm in arm toward the door. Both kept their gun hands clear. The woman was Dexter, the man a Sinister, so the man walked on the left, the woman the right. He tucked the phone away and surreptitiously adjusted the hidden pistol on his hip as he stood. The leather was a custom pancake holster from Ted Blocker, the gun a Kunin Cadet, a stainless .357 Magnum. He had 3 other pistols identical to it. If he had to shoot somebody, the gun had to go away, and since he liked the design and action, he had bought several. Of course, the mark of a good bodyguard was in not having to use the hardware. He allowed himself a small smile as he headed for the exit. Like a perfect crime, the best bodyguard was one you never knew about. He might not be the best yet, but there was still time for improvement.
Quantico, Virginia.
Sir, somebody to see you. A Dr. Morrison from Washington State.
Michaels looked up from his computer, blinking. Morrison.
Morrison. Ah, yes,
he remembered. Morrison had called yesterday, said he was in town and needed to speak to somebody at NetForce about a problem with something called HARP. Michaels had done a fast scan of the archives to find out that this was short for High Altitude Auroral Research Project, a joint endeavor that involved the Air Force, Navy, and several universities. Something to do with microwaves or some such.
Sounded like a snorer to him. Show him in.
The man who followed Michaels as secretary into the office was tall, thin, nearly bald, and looked to be about 50. He wore a plain black business suit and carried a battered aluminum briefcase. He could have passed for a professor just about anywhere.
Dr. Morrison, I'm Alex Michaels.
Commander, I didn't expect to be meeting with the head of the organization.
Michaels considered telling him that his assistant had quit and that his best computer guy was tromping around in the woods somewhere with his new girlfriend, but decided he probably wouldn't care. He smiled.
Have a seat. What can I do for you, sir?
Morrison sat awkward in his movement. Not a jock, this one.
As you may recall, I am one of the project managers on the HARP project.
You're a long way from Gokona, Alaska, Michael said.
Morrison raised an eyebrow. You know about the project?
Only where it is located and that it has to do with the ionosphere.
Morrison seemed to relax a little. He opened his briefcase and produced a mini DVD disc. Here is a rundown on HARP. I know you have a higher security clearance than I do, but this is all pretty much public background material.
Michaels took the disc.
HARP went online in the early 90s, has been operating on and off since. We are in summer hiatus just now for repairs to equipment. Essentially, HARP is the world's most powerful shortwave transmitter. It was designed to beam high-energy radio waves into the ionosphere and to perform thereby various experiments to learn about space weather. For our purposes, that's basically the flow of particles from the sun and other sources into the Earth's atmosphere. These things affect communications, satellites like that.
Michaels nodded.
Yep.
A snorer. He tried to look interested.
The array, called the FIRI, consists of 180 antenna towers on a grid of 15 columns and 12 rows on a gravel pad of some 33 acres. Each tower consists of a pair of dipole antennas that run either in the 2.8 to 7 megahertz or the 7 to 10 megahertz range. Each transmitter can generate some 10,000 watts of radio frequency power, and the combined raw output of the 360 transmitters is thus 3.6 million watts. When focused on a single spot in the sky, this is effectively multiplied a thousandfold to 3.6 billion watts.
So it's a very powerful system. And?
And there are several things we've learned along the way. Research has been primarily in four areas: communications, such as with extremely low frequency waves, or ELF, for such things as contacting submarines in the depths, tomography, the ability to see great distances underground, and even the possibility of some rudimentary weather control. There have also been some experiments with pulse generation, EMP, to knock out enemy missile guidance systems, that sort of thing.
Interesting.
Yes, it is. And, as a byproduct of the ELF research, the possibility of affecting and altering biorhythms of plant and animal life has been explored.
Michaels frowned. You want to clarify that last part for me?
We've known for a long time that long-term radio wave exposure can affect people. Increased rates of cancer under power lines and the like. Civilized people live in a virtual bath of non-ionizing low-frequency waves. Everything electrical produces them. At HARP, certain areas of research involving the 0.5 to 40 hertz frequencies, the same ones that the human brain uses, have been experimented with.
Meaning?
Meaning that the Navy and Air Force are very interested in the idea of the possibility that HARP could give them a non-destructive weapon technology.
Michaels leaned back in his chair. What? Are we talking about mind control?
It is a possibility, though not yet feasible.
This really was interesting. It's been a while since my last physics class, Dr. Morrison, but the difference between hertz radio waves and megahertz is considerable, isn't it? How is it that a transmitter that produces frequencies in the, 2.8 to 10 megahertz range will do anything in the 0.5 to 40 hertz range? Morrison gave him a smile, as might a professor discovering a bright student who has picked up something the rest of the class missed.
Ah, very good, Commander. You are correct. A hertz is one cycle per second. A megahertz is a million cycles per second. So, in order for such high-frequency broadcast energy to be, stepped down by this magnitude requires a considerable change in the length of the broadcasting antenna. Generally speaking, an antenna must be as long as the wavelength it transmits. So, 30 megahertz waves would require a 10-meter antenna, and 30 hertz waves would need about a 1,000-kilometer antenna.
I wouldn't think there are a lot of 1,000-kilometer antennas lying around.
You'd be surprised. An antenna needn't be made of steel girders. You can make one out of coils of wire, or transmitters linked electronically, or several other ways. For our purposes, We use the sky itself. The Earth is essentially a giant magnet, surrounded by incoming cosmic and solar radiation. A certain number of these solar winds spiral in and down at the magnetic poles in what is known as the electrojet. This is what causes the aurora, the northern and southern lights. With HARP, we can, in effect, turn the length of the electrojet into a kind of antenna, and by certain electronic manipulations, make it as long as we want, within limits, of course.
I see. And this means you can generate frequencies that might affect human mental processes with a lot of broadcast power behind them over a long distance.
It does.
Are you here as a whistleblower, Dr. Morrison? I'm the wrong guy. You want to be talking to the DOD.
No, no. Nothing like that. There's nothing wrong with the military seeking out new weaponry. That's part of their job, isn't it? The Russians have been playing with this stuff for years, and it would be foolish for our government to ignore the potential. No, I'm here because I'm certain somebody has been sneaking into our computers and stealing the information about our experiments.
Ah.
Yes. And because I don't know who might be doing it, I came to you rather than my superiors.
Michaels nodded. Now it made sense. And how is it you came to believe somebody has been stealing information?
Morrison smiled and took another DVD from his briefcase. They left footprints.
Vermilion River, Lafayette, Louisiana. Michaels sat in the stern of a 12-foot aluminum bateau, his hand on the control arm of the little electric trolling motor. The sluggish waters of the bayou flowed past. On the shores to either side, huge live oaks loomed, gray Spanish moss hanging down like ragged organic curtains. He angled toward the east bank to avoid a half-submerged log floating toward him. Or was that a gator? Michael smiled. Jay had done a terrific job on this scenario. It felt so real. Ahead, the virtual reality construct that represented the HARP facility's computer system stood on the east bank of the bayou, the image of a backwoods bar. A juke joint. The building was wooden, painted white with a slanting, corrugated metal roof, and the exterior walls were hung with metal beer and soft drink signs whose paint was flaking and peeling. Falstaff, Jack's, Royal Crown Cola, Dr. Pepper. A small mountain of rusting steel cans avalanched toward the riverbank to the side of the ramshackle building. Michaels was close enough to see the empty cans had pairs of triangular-shaped holes punched into the tops. Opened with what his father used to call a church key, long before pull or pop tabs were invented. He guided the boat toward the shore. Virtual reality hadn't turned out quite the way the early computer geeks had imagined. With the power and input devices available, virtual reality could be, well, virtually anything. It was up to the person who designed the scenario. The constructs were analogies, of course, but configured so that people could relate to them intuitively. Normal people didn't want to push buttons or click on icons, no matter how cute these things were. What they really wanted was to be surrounded by a setting in which they could behave like people. Instead of tapping at a keyboard, they could hike a mountain trail, ride a horse through the Old West, or, like Michaels, take a small boat down a dark and slow-flowing bayou. You could buy off-the-shelf software, have it custom designed by somebody who knew about such things, or do it yourself. Michaels was the head of NetForce, so he had to at least have a passing familiarity with doing it himself, and he did. But it was much easier to let Jay Gridley or one of the other hotshot ops build them. These guys really got into it. You could go places, interact with other people, get into computer systems, and what you saw and did might have no relationship to what other people in the same location saw or did. It was personal, unless you opted for the default scenario or agreed to a consensus reality. A lot of people did that, picked one setting, in order to have a common experience. But Michaels liked his or Jay's imagery better. If you could do it, then why not? The bateau bumped against the pilings of the little dock, and Michaels killed the outboard and hopped up onto the creosoted wooden planks. He tied the boat up and started for the bar. From this angle, he could see the name of the place, the Dewdrop Inn. Oh, boy. In reality,
He was sitting in his office more than 50 years away from this place, wearing ear and eye bands, hands in skeletal sensory gloves, seeing and feeling the computer's imagery. And he was aware of that on some level, though he had learned to tune the real reality out, as had most people who spent any time in VR. Normally, he would have had Jay or one of the other serious players investigating this, but the truth was, he needed the diversion. He ambled toward the juke joint. A swarthy bearded man wearing overalls, no shirt and no shoes, leaned against the wall next to the entrance. The man smiled, showing gaps in his mostly rotten teeth. In VR, firewalls came in all kinds of configurations.
Well, yee-haw, Michaels thought. Welcome to the shallow end of the gene pool, boy.
Ain't open,
Overalls said. Michaels nodded.
Uh-huh. Guess I'll have to come back later.
Reckon so.
Michaels smiled and walked away. He retreated to the small dock, got into his boat, cast off, and cranked the motor. Around the next bend in the bayou, maybe 300 yards further upstream, he put back into shore, tied the bateau to a low-hanging willow tree branch, and hiked back toward the Dewdrop Inn. He circled around behind it, being careful not to let Overalls see him. The back door was of unpainted wooden planks, crude but solid. He fished around in his pocket and pulled out a skeleton key. In reality, the key was a password provided by Dr. Morrison, but one couldn't expect to have a coded keypad lock in this kind of scenario. It wouldn't be appropriate. The spring lock clicked open. Michaels quickly stepped inside and closed the door behind him. The inside of the place was pretty much a match for the outside, a 1950s backwoods bar. There were scarred wooden tables, beat-up cane-bottom bent-back chairs, and a row of stools in front of a bar that had seen decades of spilled beers and misplaced cigarettes. It took only a minute or so for Michaels to find the built-in lockbox under the bar, a steel plate with a huge master lock padlock on a finger-thick brass hasp. Michaels had a key to the padlock, but since he didn't know what was in the lockbox, it wouldn't much matter what he'd find in it if he bothered to look. If something was missing, he wouldn't be able to tell by looking. It was dim behind the bar. He pulled a small flashlight from his back pocket and shined it at the lock. Sure enough, there were fresh scratches on the lock and on the hasp. Somebody had been at it, trying to pry or pick it open. No way to tell if they had managed it, but it confirmed Morrison's story, at least in part. Michael stood and started for the back door. Morrison could have done it, of course. Somebody yelled fire. A big part of the time, he was the guy with the match. Then again, why bring it up? Nobody would have noticed without Morrison's report, at least nobody in NetForce. And Morrison had access to the lockbox, which was, of course, nothing more than a protected set of files inside the HARP computer system. He could open it whenever he wanted. There was no need for him to break into it. Well, he'd have to call Morrison back, get some more specific information. It didn't seem particularly vital. There were people he could pass it off to, or he could wait until Jay got back from his vacation. He could drop out of VR now and unplug. But what the hell? Might as well finish the bateau ride. Enjoy the sights a little more, hey? Monday, June 6th, Mammoth Cave, Kentucky. John Howard smiled as the guide turned the lights off, and the inside of the cave went black, a darkness deeper than most people had ever seen. In the gloom, the guide said, "No sunlight ever gets down here, and yet people explored this cave much further along than we are now, using only candles and burning torches. Before the electric lights were wired in, everybody carried a lot of spare batteries and bulbs for their flashlights, believe it." The tourists, unseen in the dark, chuckled nervously. Somebody punched a digital phone's keypad and a green light went on. Somebody else tapped a control on his or her wristwatch and lit the face up. The guide switched the lights back on, and there was a collective sigh of relief to be able to see again. She said,
We guides have a standing bet that anybody leading a tour group that doesn't light a phone or watch or even a cigarette light or a keyring flash during the 30 seconds of darkness here gets treated to lunches for a week. Nobody has won the pool in 6 months. Again, the small crowd laughed, a little less nervously this time. Howard looked at his wife and son, saw Tyrone smile at his girlfriend, Nadine, who just happened to have the same name as Howard's wife. Howard resisted the urge to smile at how cute they looked. Right now, Ty and his friend were boomerang-throwing buddies. A month from now, they could be trying some entirely new game that Howard knew they were much too young to be trying. Nadine, his Nadine, slipped her hand under his arm. "Where'd you go? You just developed the long stare." He did smile at his wife. "Just watching the kids." "Feeling old?"
"Oh, yeah.
But that's only half of it. Feeling helpless is the hard part. I have all this accumulated wisdom."
"You wish."
"Okay. Experience, then, and Tyrone doesn't want to take advantage of it. Seems like such a waste."
"But that's how it is.
Rain's gonna come down no matter what you want. You can stay inside, go out and get wet, or take an umbrella. The rain doesn't care."
"I knew there was a reason I married you. Your mind."
"That's not what you used to say."
"Well, I suppose you had a couple of other attractions."
"You mean you used to think so before I got fat and ugly?"
"You're better looking than the day we met. Going senile and losing your mind, maybe, but fat and ugly? Shit, woman. Give me a break."
She smiled. He liked making her do that. Even after more than 15 years, it still made him feel good.
"It's good for us to get away for a while," she said. "I'm having a good time."
"Me too," he said. And he was. He hadn't thought about Netforce for the better part of an hour. Easy.
Seattle, Washington. Morrison pushed an electronic card across the table to Ventura. "Here is the retainer. $100,000. He'd had to drain his savings and take out a second mortgage on his house to get the money. Ventura's services weren't cheap. $30,000 a month for the basic plan, and it went up from there. But he was supposedly the best there was, and Morrison knew he needed the best. He'd be broke by the end of July if the deal didn't happen. But there wasn't any real doubt that it would. Only with whom and for how much. He needed to stay alive until then, of course. Ventura took the card with its embedded credit chip.
"Beginning when?"
"Immediately." Ventura took a small phone from his pocket, touched a button.
"Where on?"
Morrison couldn't help but look around. The restaurant was not all that crowded, but he couldn't see anybody who looked like a bodyguard looking about. Ventura smiled.
"You won't see them."
"Them?"
"There are two ops in here with us, two more outside. Now, I need some information if I'm going to protect you properly. Who might be wanting to kidnap or kill you, and why?"
Morrison nodded. Here's where it got tricky. He could offer a good story and probably have the man buy it, or he could tell the truth. Since his life was going to be on the line, he did not want to make a misstep here. "I'm not certain of the who yet. Probably the Chinese, but it could be the Russians or maybe the Israelis. The why is because I am in possession of certain, highly useful information they would like to get their hands on."
"From Harp?"
Morrison blinked, taken aback for a moment. Well, of course the man would have checked him out. Morrison considered his response, and while he was doing it, Ventura said,
"Doctor, I don't much care what it is you are doing, but if I am going to keep you alive, I want to know what I am apt to be dealing with. It makes a big difference in how we proceed, you understand? If you boink somebody's wife and he wants to beat you to a pulp, that's one thing. If we are going to be dealing with the secret police of a major foreign country, that's something else. I'll take the job either way, but I need to know everything. We're talking about your life and the lives of my crew."
Morrison nodded. He took a deep breath. "All right." And for the next 15 minutes, he laid it out, answering questions as he did so. Ventura did not take notes. He also did not seem disturbed,
to hear what Morrison had to say. When he was done, Ventura said, "All right. I'll need your itinerary. Anywhere you go, I will make the travel arrangements. In matters of security, I am God. If I think a situation is too risky, I will tell you and you will follow my recommendations without question. Is this a problem?" "No. No problem." "Fine. What are your immediate plans?" "I have to go up to the project. We're on hiatus officially, but I am running some, calibrations. Over the next couple of weeks, I need to do at least two more of these, possibly three."
"What is the situation with security at the facility? Can I bring my people in?"
"No. I can get you in as an observer from one of the universities. We can fabricate enough background to pass the Navy and Air Force checks, but that's it. There are armed guards patrolling the perimeter of the project. Gates, guards at the door, and so forth."
Ventura nodded.
"There is one complicating factor you should know about. The facility and its computers are being investigated by NetForce."
"NetForce? The FBI suspects what you've done?"
"No. They are being guided down the path I've provided for them."
"Ah, I see. Smart. But they will suspect the messenger, you know. They always do. That's standard procedure."
"I expected they would. I'm covered."
Ventura shrugged. "I hope so. I might be able to keep you from being shot by the Chinese, but I can't keep you out of jail if you have the feds after you."
"I understand."
Morrison felt a cold hand clutching his bowels. He had started down a dangerous road. Even at this point, he could scrap the whole deal and walk away without being caught. He was certain of it. But no risk, no gain. And the gain here was enormous. No, he was committed. There was a price to be paid in human life, of course. But he was willing to pay it. Well, as long as it wasn't his.
Tuesday, June 7th, Sperryville, Virginia. A light rain pattered on the tent, but the ripstop Gore-Tex was up to it. Water beaded and ran down the roof sides. It was just after dawn. Jay Gridley lay on his back watching the drops. He was inside the two zipped-together sleeping bags next to Saji. She'd been right. He hadn't been the least bit disappointed in this camping trip. No, sir, no way. This was the best vacation he had ever had, no two ways about it. He wasn't a fan of the great outdoors. He was much more comfortable creating a VR version of it and plugging into that. But no matter how good a programmer you were, you couldn't begin to approach the reality of sex. Nope. No, sir, no way, no how. Jay glanced over at Saji, who was still asleep. God, she was beautiful. Smart, wise, everything he could possibly want in a woman. The only question was, how could he make it permanent? Would she, he wondered, laugh at him if he asked her to marry him? Saji opened her eyes and smiled at him. Thinking about asking for your money back, white boy? I'll have you know I'm half Thai, and no, I wasn't thinking about asking for my money back, thank you. Scenery was worth the trip? All the scenery I need is here in the tent. She laughed. Uh-oh. A flatterer trying to reattach me to my ego. Yes, ma'am. I'm a Buddhist's worst nightmare. Listen to me, you will fall right off the edge of the Eightfold Path. London. Tony had rented a small place when Alex had gone back to the U.S. She had some money in the bank, but London would eat that up in a big hurry now that she wasn't on an expense account. Her money would be depleted by the time her visa ran out, and she'd have to leave the country by the end of the summer. She was sitting at the small table in the kitchen, a kitchenette, really, when the doorbell chimed. Who could that be? Save for Carl and her landlord, nobody knew she lived here. When she opened the door, the last person she expected to see stood there. MI6 agent Angela Cooper. Tony was stunned. The bitch. How dare she come here? Tony clamped a lid on the rush of anger. Polite might be too much to ask for, but she kept her voice even. What do you want? Cooper flashed a weak smile. She was a beautiful woman, no doubt of that.
I need to speak to you. May I come inside?
Tony offered a bored shrug.
Sure. Come in.
Once inside, Cooper looked nervous. She sure as hell should be, Tony thought.
I won't be here but a moment or two. Listen, I've wrestled with this and I can't come up with any clever way to say it, so here it is flat out. I didn't sleep with Alex Michaels.
No, I expect you didn't get much sleeping done.
Cooper shook her head. You have it wrong. We did not have sex, not in any way, shape, or form, not even by Clinton definition. I wanted to, but he turned me down.
It caught Tony flat-footed.
What? Yes. I know I made it seem as if we had, but it didn't happen. I tried my best, but he wouldn't go for it.
Tony waved at the table. This was astounding.
You want to sit down? Was she telling the truth? Had Alex put her up to this? Cooper read her mind. In case you're wondering, no, Alex didn't ask me to talk to you. I heard what happened between you two. I was going to let it pass. When he wouldn't do me, I was, well, a bit put out, so I decided to sting you a little by letting on that we had. But despite his rejection, I did like Alex, and it isn't really fair to make him suffer because he was doing right by you.
Alex didn't deny it when I brought it up, Tony said.
I don't understand why not. It had been a long day. We had supper in the pub. He had one beer too many, and I offered to give him a massage. But that was as far as it got. He was half asleep when I stripped and tried to get him to have it off with me. I was ready, and it was obvious he was ready, too. But instead of his willy, he waved you in my face. I was furious, and I resented you for having him. So that's why I did what I did. I'm sorry. That's it.
She turned and started for the door. Tony had trouble finding her voice.
Angela.
Yes?
Thank you for telling me. It couldn't have been easy.
Cooper smiled, more genuine this time.
I'd rather be having a bloody root canal. You're lucky to have a man like that interested in you. Maybe you can patch things up.
When she was gone, Tony sat at the table staring at the wall.
Why hadn't he just told her?
She replayed their last meeting, trying to remember exactly how it had gone.
Had he ever actually said he'd been with Cooper?
No.
Well, shit. What the hell was wrong with him? Why had he let her think he'd done it?
Tony felt tears spill. Damn it, Alex! She was angry all over again, but this time for an entirely different reason.
What on earth could he have been thinking?
Wednesday, June 8th. Gakona, Alaska. Is that where we're going?
Ventura had to raise his voice for Morrison to hear him. Normally a plane like the Cessna Stationair was not that noisy while cruising, but this one had a slightly warped door edge on the passenger side that added a loud, almost whistle.
That's the place, Morrison said.
Ventura looked down. In the distance was a snow-capped mountain range. The Harp site itself was cut out of the forest in the rough shape of a skeleton key. Several buildings and a parking lot in a ragged circular area were connected by a straight road to the array itself, which looked as if somebody had planted seeds that grew up to be giant 1950s-style television antennas. Beyond that was a second rectangular array, as large as the first. Behind the control buildings, and just coming into view, was a long, straight-paved strip a couple of thousand feet long.
We've got our own landing strip now, Morrison said. Better security. It wasn't a problem when they built the place. Anybody could just walk up to the front gate. But there was some ugly vandalism by eco-terrorists. So now there's a big chain-link fence and armed military guards. The nearest town, such as it is, Gakona, is over that way. There's a post office, a gas station, a motel, and a couple of bread-and-breakfast places, a restaurant, a bar, like that. They get a lot of tourists, hunters and fishermen up here. 49 permanent residents.
Ventura nodded.
It drops to 40 or 50 below in the dark of winter, and usually there are a couple of feet of white, fluffy powder.
Ventura smiled politely. He had done some background research before they'd flown into Anchorage. He probably knew more about the terrain and local country than Morrison did, but he didn't let on. In almost every situation, knowledge was power, and because you worked for a man, didn't mean that you trusted him. From what he had learned, the Harp site was 100-some-odd miles northeast of Anchorage, almost to the Wrangell Mountains, the high range that divided Alaska from the Canadian Yukon. He already knew that the nearest town was Gakona. 100 years ago, somebody had built a roadhouse, the Gakona Lodge, and it was still there, now a restaurant. If you didn't work for Harp, or against it, and there were some who did that, work against it, you came up here to hunt, fish, hike, canoe, kayak, ski, or snowboard. The pilot, who was a grizzled-looking man of maybe 50, lined up on the narrow runway. A lot of these bush pilots were experts, and this one was better than most, because after he'd left the Navy, where he'd flown jets off and on to an aircraft carrier, he had flown crop dusters for a living down in Central California. Ventura had checked him out, too. When you took on a client, you didn't take any chances. You examined everybody who got within rifle range of your charge, and it wasn't that hard to do. Ventura subscribed to a computer investigative service. You logged into the site, gave them your password and the name of whoever or whatever you wanted to know about, and within a few minutes, usually, they came back with as extensive a report as was available. The service had access, however legally, to Social Security, state motor vehicle departments, credit bureaus, police computer nets, and a bunch of others they wouldn't talk about. It was an expensive service, but they were pretty good. Good enough to track and define most honest people. Spotting the others was his job. If it took one to know one, he certainly ought to know a shooter. The pilot brought the plane in smoothly. Once they were out with their bags, the pilot headed from the apron back to the runway. It was warm, high 70s or low 80s, Ventura figured. Morrison said, "Didn't think it would be so warm, eh?" "Actually, I was wondering where the mosquitoes were. They're usually pretty bad this time of year in the lake valleys." Morrison blinked, apparently surprised that Ventura wasn't surprised by the temperature. "Well, the DOD has a guy who comes out and fogs the site every now and then. So you've been to Alaska before. Why didn't you say so?"
"It never came up," Ventura smiled.
"Come on. I'll show you the setup. There's a fuel cell cart in the shed. It's a mile or so to the front gate from here. We'll ride."
Ventura nodded. He adjusted the pistol in his belt holster. It had been there since they'd left Seattle. There were half a dozen ways he knew of to avoid having to pack your weapon in your luggage. People who thought you couldn't carry a gun onto a commercial jet were only fooling themselves. Fooling himself was not Ventura's game. Washington, D.C. Michaels felt as if he were 1,000 years old as he held the phone's receiver in a death grip. He kept his voice as light as he could. "Really great, Dadster, and all the kids in my class love him." His daughter was talking about Byron Baumgartner, a teacher at her school in Boise, and his ex-wife Megan's boyfriend. No, not boyfriend. Fiancé. They were getting married at the end of the month, and they wanted to have Byron, the bearded wonder, adopt his daughter, move in and take over as her father, and deny Michael's visitation, if he allowed it. His initial inclination had been to fight it to the death, preferably Megan and Byron's death. He didn't like either of them right now, and at their first meeting had put the bearded wonder on his ass when the man had grabbed him. Megan had been doing her usual slash-and-burn number on him, and when he'd said something back in an angry retort, dear young Byron had taken it upon himself to defend her honor. Without thinking about it, Michaels had decked the man, thus proving that the sea lot he'd been learning actually worked. In retrospect, that had been a mistake, but, boy, it sure felt good at the time. Well, Byron the Bearded Wonder would find out about how much honor his new love had the first time he crossed her. Megan fought dirty, always had. Michaels had overlooked that for a long time, blaming himself for a lot of their troubles, but eventually he realized it wasn't all his fault. Yeah, he had spent too much time at the office, and yeah, he could withdraw into his own head. But he had been a good father, and when Megan started throwing the lousy dad crap into his face, it was hard to smile and shrug it off. But would taking his ex and her new love to the legal mat
and trying to choke them out benefit Susie? How would an ugly custody battle affect her? Susie, now 8, continued to talk about what a swell guy Byron was. And as much as he didn't want to agree with that, Michaels didn't say so. Poisoning a well was never a good idea in his mind. You never knew but that somebody you loved might drink from it, or that you might have to drink from it yourself someday. Truth was, Byron probably was a nice guy. If he'd met him away from Megan, he suspected he wouldn't have had any problems with him. Yeah, he'd been out of line when he got between a divorced couple and a long-running fight he didn't understand, but he would have done the same thing in Byron's place. So when are you coming to see me, Dadster?
Pretty soon, a little bit. Next month.
Yeah, next month. Friday, July the 1st, the day of the first round of the custody hearings. His lawyer, Phil Buchanan, was confident they could win, or at least stall things for a long time, or so he said. But the question was, did he really want to do that?
Spiffy, did Momster tell you that Scout caught a rat?
A rat? Scout was a toy poodle. Michaels had come by when an assassin, a woman disguising herself as an old lady walking her dog, had used the little beast as part of her subterfuge. Fortunately for him, the dog had barked at just the right time, saving his life. He'd thought about keeping the pooch, but figured he needed more attention than he could give a pet, so now Scout was his daughter's companion.
Oh, yeah, we heard them fighting under the porch last night, and then Scout came out dragging it by the neck. He bit Scout on the leg, so we had to take Scout to the vet to get a shot so he wouldn't get rat disease. He's okay, though. I gotta go, Daddy. Daddy B is coming over to take us to the new IMAX 3D. I love you.
I love you too, honey. Bye.
Michael stared at the phone. Daddy B. Well, okay, sure. What was she gonna call him? An 8-year-old using his first name somehow wasn't right, but... Daddy B? Michael sure as hell didn't need to hear that, regardless of what was best for his child. That wasn't right either. So what was he going to do about all this? He had only a few weeks to decide, and the decision would affect him and his daughter for the rest of their lives. Wasn't that just one more straw his camel didn't need? His life had become a damned soap opera. London.
Are you sure? Carl asked.
Tony nodded and sighed.
Yes, I have to go.
They were in Carl's Silat school, which occupied the second floor of a 4-story building between a tandoori restaurant and a boarded-up charity shop in a less-than-posh section of town called Clapham. The school was bare bones, old wooden floors and a few mats. Carl nodded in return.
I understand.
Impulsively, Tony put her hand on his chest. Under the thin white T-shirt, the muscle was tight and warm.
Thank you. I appreciate all you've taught me.
He caught her hand with his, pressed it against his pectoral a bit harder.
It has been mutual. Listen, if things don't go well with your Mr. Michaels, let me know soonest, would you?
I will.
I have occasion to visit the States now and then. I'd be pleased to see you there, whether this works out with Alex or not.
I'd like that.
Are you going to stay for class?
No.
I need to get packed. My flight leaves early in the morning.
He bent and kissed her gently on the lips.
Travel safely.
Tony nodded and smiled. Carl was a path not taken, and she had a feeling she would always wonder how it would have been to travel that way. Tony could have had her calm receive Alex's daily call, could make the connection herself and ask him about it from thousands of miles away. No risks to that. But no long-distance voice, even complete with a video image, was enough for such a conversation. She needed to be able to see into his eyes. If what Cooper had said was true, if he hadn't cheated on her, then what would that mean? She had left him, quit her job, and if she had done it because she had made a mistake, it was a very big fucking mistake. If she had been that wrong, then what did that say about her? She had to know, one way or another. Thursday, June 9th, Gakona, Alaska. Morrison had given Ventura the tour of the facility, but the man hadn't seemed too awed or even interested by anything. Morrison could understand why Ventura wasn't all that impressed. A lot of the older buildings that were supposed to have been temporary were still there. These were no more than trailers with cheap wood paneling and beat-up old computers and monitors, steel desks and pressboard filing cabinets, not what you thought of as cutting edge. Still, impressing Ventura was not the point. Running the next test was. Which was what he was about to do. He had another target, and the conditions were as good as they were going to get this time of year, so he was ready to begin. Ventura stood behind him wearing a disguise that ought to fool anybody here into thinking he belonged. Black polyester slacks over brown loafers, a white shirt with a pen protector in the pocket, an ugly vest, uglier tie, and dark plastic-rimmed glasses. A perfect geek. There was a gun tucked onto the vest, Morrison was certain, but even though he knew it was there, he couldn't see it. The controls in the auxiliary trailer worked as well as the main ones, but they were less likely to have unexpected visitors here. Morrison said, "With our computers up, and if the sunspot activity isn't too bad, we can hit the mark 98 times out of 100. He adjusted a control, and a liquid crystal display of numbers flashed new digits. He and Ventura were alone in the HARP auxiliary control room. The ACR was where Morrison usually conducted his calibrations, and, in this case, an unauthorized use of the equipment. The thing was, you couldn't tell by looking where the energy generated by the array was going. Since the project was shut down for the summer, except for maintenance and calibrations, no real scientists would be looking over his shoulder, and the guards wouldn't have a clue what he was really doing. Morrison powered up the system for his test. Warning buzzers started to sound. A red light flashed on and off on the control board. He reached for the control, a covered button. The buzzers continued their howl, the lights their strobe, as he raised the cover, then pressed the button. Multnomah Falls, Oregon. John Howard stood by the stone restaurant watching his family look at the thin ribbon of water cascading down from a great height to splash into a cold pool at the base of the cliff. They were about 25 or so miles outside of Portland, in the Columbia River Gorge, looking at one of the highest waterfalls in the country, more than a 600-foot drop in the second stage here. It was beautiful. Howard reached for the Virgil, the virtual global interface link hooked to his belt. This was a great toy, not much bigger than a standard pager or a small cell phone, and it not only had a comm, it was a working GPS, clock, radio, TV, modem, credit card, camera, scanner, and even a tiny fax that produced weave wire hard copy. There were civilian models, but the military units were better, at least for now. Sharper image was gaining, so he had heard. Sergeant Julio Fernandez appeared on the Virgil's tiny screen, smiling.
"Congratulations, General. I didn't think you'd make it this long. I guess one of the others will win the pool."
"I'm merely calling to check in, Sergeant."
"The country is getting along fine without you, sir. No wars, no terrorists taking over at Quantico. Well, if you don't count the new FEEB recruits, and the Republic endures."
"I just wanted to let you know where I was."
"John, your GPS sends us a homing signal as long as it's got power, remember? We know where you are. You want me to give you your longitude and latitude?"
"Nobody likes a smart-ass NCO, Julio.
Come on, you're on vacation. Relax. Enjoy yourself. I'll call if the Swiss or the French decide to invade the country, I promise."
Howard made a suggestion that was anatomically impossible, and unlikely for a heterosexual even if it had been possible.
Fernandez laughed. "That's a discom, General. Adios."
Howard smiled as he rehooked the Virgil to his belt. Well, yes, he did sometimes think things would go to hell if he left town. So he was a warrior. What could he say? Nadine and the children were hot to climb up to the little bridge closer to the falls, and Howard went along. It was all part of the ambience, to get wet, wasn't it? Howard smiled as they climbed into the waterfall mist. Julio was right. He needed to relax and enjoy his vacation. His son was growing up, and pretty soon he'd be a lot more interested in girls and cars than boomerangs and family trips. Might as well enjoy it while he could. He was out in the Wild West. Nothing of any major military importance was apt to happen here. Certainly nothing he needed to worry about. Nadine looked back at him and smiled.
Isn't this fun?
Yep, he said. It is. Quantico, Virginia. Jay Gridley wasn't exactly thrilled about having to go back to work. Yeah, sure, it was what he did, and yeah, sure, he loved it. But rolling around with Saji, even in the drafty tent in the rainy woods, well, that had work beat all hollow. He never thought he'd hear himself think that, but there it was. Truth was, even though he was dropping by the Net Force compound late Thursday afternoon, he didn't really have to be back until Monday. But Saji had clients she had to counsel. In her net persona of the old Tibetan priest, Sojan Rinpoche, Saji taught basic Buddhism and also offered a kind of psycho-spiritual first aid to people who had suffered various forms of brain damage, usually secondary to drugs or stroke. That was how they'd met, online, when Jay had been zapped while chasing the guy with the quantum computer. Saji had an apartment in Los Angeles, but she was going to be working out of Jay's place, at least for now, and he hoped he could convince her to make it permanent, though he hadn't yet worked up the nerve to ask her to move in, much less to marry him. But he was gonna, eventually. Commander Michaels was in his office when Jay got there. Jay tapped at the door, then opened it.
Hey, boss.
Jay, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be back until Monday. How did it go?
The mosquitoes got so bad we had to come back for a transfusion. Other than that, it went great. How's business?
Slow. Nothing major, thank God. Jay wanted to ask if Michaels had heard from Tony Fiorella. Her quitting had hit the NetForce group hard, but he didn't bring it up. He still didn't know what exactly had gone down between her and the boss. It must have been bad, though. Michaels had been pretty miserable about it.
Nothing interesting at all?
Nope. Well, one little thing. You know about something called HARP?
Sure. The atmosphere burner up in Alaska. The guys in aluminum foil hats love that one. What happened? It melt down?
According to one of the scientists working on the thing, somebody sneaked in and stole something from their computer.
Who would bother? The technology is moldy. Goes back to Tesla more than 100 years ago.
Michael shrugged. Got me. I did a little web walking in VR, and it does look as if somebody got into their computer.
Kid hacker, maybe.
Could be. You want to check it out? Be my guest.
Saji is going to be busy for the next couple days. I'll take a look at it, get a jump on work.
Background than what I saw is in the work file under HARP.
Copy, boss. See you Monday morning.
Jay went to his office. He had checked his email and phone messages using a Virgil he'd checked out and taken with him, so he was pretty much up to date. Just for grins, he lit his computer and read over the information on HARP the boss had given him, including the hidden cam vid of the interview with the scientist Morrison. Very interesting stuff. That would be worth stealing, but that also didn't seem likely. People had been playing with low-frequency stuff for a long time without much in the way of results. Still, it was intriguing. Jay logged off his computer. He'd been here for a couple of hours, time to head home. Saji didn't have to be online all the time. But as he started for the door to leave, his comm chirped, and the sexy, throaty female vox he'd programmed into his computer said, "Jay, priority one comm, Jay, heads up. Answer the phone, you hunk of burning love." Friday, June 10th, Longhua, China. When he had been a member of the Chinese army 20 years before, Jing Luhuan had apparently at some point collected a Russian Makarov pistol and kept it hidden away for 2 decades afterward. No one had ever seen him with it, at least no one alive who could testify to that. There seemed no other way he could have come by such a thing. However he came by it, it was with this pistol that Jing proceeded to shoot 17 members of his home village in the wee hours of Friday morning. He walked calmly through the town, plinking at anybody who came out to see what the noise was about, and he did not discriminate as to sex, age, or familial relationships. By dawn, he had shot men, women, children, friends, and relatives. He had 2 dozen rounds of ammunition remaining for the pistol after he shot number 17, his butt-ugly and ignorant cousin Lo Tang. But it was moot as to how many more he might have wounded or killed, given that he was overwhelmed at that point by 6 villagers and hacked to pieces by their sickles and scythes. The bloody tatters remaining of Jing were pounded into the hard ground under their sandals, but their weapons to each other.
The only apparent survivor of this melee had a short-lived triumph, as he was murdered shortly thereafter by a middle-aged schoolteacher wielding a pair of hedge-trimming shears, with which she deftly snipped his left carotid artery. The teacher then used the shears on herself, plunging them into her belly more than 10 times before shock and loss of blood overcame her. A block away, 4 women were killed by a fifth when she drove a 48-year-old Ford tractor into and then back and forth over the 4 until the tractor ran out of gasoline an hour later. She fell asleep sitting there. In the town's only decent food market, 19 people who had fled there to avoid the carnage were trapped inside when a teenaged girl set the place on fire. They were all cooked. The girl in turn was killed by an elderly woman who sneaked up behind her and smashed her skull with a shovel. And she, in turn, was slain by a very large, naked man who grabbed and fell on her, suffocating her under his bulk as he lay there giggling. In a period of 6 hours, 97 residents were killed. 21 others were wounded seriously enough so that they would later die from their injuries, and 100 more were injured badly enough so they needed hospitalization. Nobody knew about this immediately because the landline communication wires out of town had been cut and then burned by a man who used part of the wire to hang himself. The town of Longhua had seen better days. Thursday, June 9th, Quantico, Virginia. Michaels looked up from his laptop and the hard copy reports, photographs, and vids at Jay. "How did we get this? It's so detailed." Jay said, "Some of the pictures and vids are retro SpySat and computer OGS. Some came from the Chinese investigating team. Some from a bashed-up and bloody camera found on the scene. The reports we got from my friend in the CIA, who got it like the CIA usually gets such things, they bought it from one of their Chinese computer spies set up to find such things. It's all fresh stuff, really fresh." Michaels looked back at the hard copy picture of the women who had been murdered by tractor. They were mostly mush and hardly recognizable as humans. "What do we know? And why do we at NetForce need to know it?" Jay said, "Longhua, China, a mountain town 150 kilometers or so north and east of Beijing, approaching Old Mongolia. Nothing much happens in Longhua, or at least it didn't used to. According to my CIA mole, there's another village called, He looked at the laptop on the table in front of him. Daru, which is a couple thousand kilometers south of Longhua, on the coast across from Formosa. Same thing happened there a few days ago. The Chinese, of course, are sweating buckets trying to keep the lid on, but our sources say it was another verse of this song, group insanity coupled with murderous violence. Survivors in both towns tell the same tale. All of a sudden, everybody went bugfuck and started attacking everybody else, no reason. This includes those who lived to be interviewed. They were minding their own business and blap, they were enveloped in a killing rage that overwhelmed them. None of them can explain it. It just suddenly seemed like a good idea to fold, spindle, or mutilate their family and neighbors to death."
"What do the Chinese investigators think?"
"They don't have a clue. They've checked for drugs, poison, psychedelics in the water, diseases, the weather, earthquake activity, even bad feng shui, and they haven't found anything. Whatever caused it came and went, and it didn't leave any traces."
"And what does the CIA think?"
"The CIA doesn't think, boss. It just collects data and passes it along. I have a standing order with my pal for anything weird. It comes in as a priority one call, which is why we got it."
"I'm sure your friend would be happy to hear you have such a high opinion of him. What do you think?"
"Well, what this looks like to me is some kind of deliberate test."
Michael stared into space. "And you think it's the Chinese doing it to their own people?"
"Can't say for sure, but why not? Take out a few, who's going to miss him? They've got more than 1 billion more where those came from."
"Jay?"
"Sorry, bad taste. I apologize."
"But the Chinese investigators seem surprised from these reports. Wouldn't they know?"
"Left hand not telling the right what it's doing? Happens all the time, all over. State doesn't tell the CIA. The spooks don't tell the Army. We're part of the FBI, and the feebs don't tell us a whole lot of things. Why would things be any better in China? That's assuming the investigators aren't part of the cover-up."
"And why is it our problem, Jay?"
"When you asked me to poke around in that harp thing, this came in almost immediately. It rang a bell. You remember the guy you told me about who came by while I was camping, the scientist from HARP?
Morrison, right?"
"Uh-huh. Well, he mentioned something about mind control and low-frequency radio waves.
He said it wasn't feasible.
Maybe not, or maybe it is. Maybe the Chinese were the ones poking around in the HARP computers, and maybe they swiped it. It just seemed awfully coincidental, given that this was exactly the kind of thing somebody would want to do if they could do it.
The Chinese?
Possible. Maybe the HARP guys found some piece of the puzzle, and the Chinese knew where to use it. It's kind of a stretch, but I'd check it out.
Michaels nodded. I hope you were wrong. All right, find out what you can. If this thing in China is connected to it, I don't want us to be caught flat-footed. At the very least, we need to be able to say we're investigating it if somebody should ask.
After Jay left, Michaels took several deep breaths.
Let it be some virus they couldn't find and not something they swiped from a U.S. computer. Please, I really don't need this right now, or ever. Washington, D.C. It was well after dark when Tony's plane landed at Dulles.
She'd had to switch from the jumbo jet to a smaller craft in New York, and she knew she'd catch hell if her mother found out she had been at JFK and hadn't called the Bronx to at least say hello. But she couldn't deal with that yet. Her mother would want to know all about it, what had happened with Alex, and even Guru would need more details than Tony was ready to provide. No, the conversation about Alex and sex and love would have to wait until she could pay a visit to one of her college buds. The cab ride through the sticky summer night to Alex's was incredibly fast, as of course it would be, since she was suddenly not in a real hurry to get there. Back in London, thousands of miles away, this had seemed urgent and absolutely necessary. The closer she got, the less brilliant the idea seemed. Just showing up on Alex's doorstep, no call, no warning. What if he wasn't home? What if he didn't want to talk to her? What if he wasn't alone? That had just come to her for the first time. The grinning, green-eyed monster popped up like magic in her mind. She hated the feeling, and she really hated not being able to prevent it. She didn't really think Alex would have found somebody else, given his track record. He hadn't dated anybody to speak of for years after he and his ex-wife had split, but you never knew. Tony shook her head at her thought. Okay, fine. Whatever. She wasn't going there for some kind of tearful movie reconciliation. She was going there for some answers. Answers that Alex, by God, owed her. And thinking of there all of a sudden, here they were. Alex's condo was on a fairly quiet street in a solid upper-middle-class neighborhood filled with condos and houses much like his. The residences were comfortable and in keeping with the kind of job Alex had. Nice place, nice neighborhood, and until that horrible moment in London, nice guy. She had to know what had happened to change that. It didn't make any sense. Tony paid the cabbie, towed her single suitcase on its built-in wheels to the front door and stood there. And stood there. And stood there some more. There were lights on inside, and it wasn't that late. All she had to do was push the doorbell. She realized that she was breathing too fast and that her hands were damp. She was, she realized, afraid. And coming from a solid base of being able to protect herself, that was really scary. She took a deep breath. She pushed the doorbell. She heard it ring. There was a space of time, how long she couldn't say, but subjectively, about 10 or 15,000 years. Yes. His voice over the intercom was the first time she'd heard him speak since he'd left London 7 weeks ago. It was a sound she hadn't realized how much she had missed until she heard it, and the simple question stunned her, so that all she could say was, "Hi."
"Tony? Don't move. I'll be right there."
And despite whatever she had felt, it warmed her to hear the joy in his voice. Gakona, Alaska. Ventura made the rounds of his surveillance stations. He was running a basic 6-person team, not counting himself, and that was not really enough considering what his client was into, but as much as he was likely to get away with up here in the middle of nowhere. Disguised as a birdwatching club out looking for owls, it gave his people a reason to be out with binoculars and starlight scopes and cameras, but it was still something of a stretch to have them wandering around in the woods. The locals would surely notice his people, and while they had all the proper gear and had done enough quick research to fake it, they wouldn't fool any real birders they might run into. Fortunately, there wasn't much in the way of law enforcement up here, so even if somebody thought the birders were a bit odd, they weren't likely to call the cops, and even if they did, it probably wouldn't be the top priority for an overextended Alaskan police force. Weird-looking bird watchers? Isn't that redundant? What are they doing? Walking around in the woods, looking through their binoculars? Oh, wow, how sinister. What? You think they've come to steal the trees? Huh? Smuggle Kodiak bears down into the lower 48? Come on. Ventura had installed them at the Two Moose Lodge, a relatively new 15-unit motel a few miles from the harp site. Aside from five ops tromping around outside where they could watch the comings and going around the last room on the west end of the building where Ventura had put the client, there was an op in the room, a young woman. Armed with a short-barreled shotgun, a snub-nosed revolver, and a couple of knives, Missy White would surely be a big surprise for an unsuspecting assassin who assumed from her bubble butt and perky breasts, all of which were barely hidden under a miniskirt and halter top, that she was a piece of fluff and harmless. If the locals knew Morrison was married, they'd likely assume Missy was a girlfriend he'd brought up here into the woods for fun, where his wife wouldn't be the wiser. And the wife wasn't apt to drop by unannounced, because a pair of Ventura's ops were parked in a rented house in Port Townsend on the Morrison Street, keeping an eye on Mrs. Morrison. You had to assume that if somebody came after the client, they'd probably consider a pass at his wife worthwhile. It hadn't taken the ops, another male and female team, but a few hours to figure out that Shannon Morrison, nay Shannon Bell, wasn't the world's most faithful spouse. Since they'd begun the surveillance on Monday, Mrs. Morrison had visited a young and well-built leather worker, one Ray Duncan, and stayed in his shop behind a locked door three times for more than an hour each visit. It was the opinion of Ventura's ops that Mrs. Morrison was not being custom-fitted for moccasins. Ventura saw no reason to mention this to his client. Mrs. Morrison's extramarital activities weren't relevant to protecting the client. Yet, anyway. "Situation?" Ventura asked. The man to whom he was speaking looked to be about 60, gray and grizzled, wearing a fisherman's vest and floppy-brimmed canvas hat, overalls and boots, and a pair of binoculars and a digital cam dangling from around his neck. A battered copy of Peterson's Guide to Birds of North America stuck out of a vest pocket next to a small flashlight. The older man laughed. "Well, let me see. About 30 minutes ago, something that looked like a big rat ran behind the garbage bin over there. Maybe it was a nutria or a possum. Zoology is not my strong suit. And 15 minutes ago, a light went on in the bathroom of unit number 5, stayed on for 2 minutes, then went out. What else? Oh, yeah. A couple of real big mosquitoes buzzed me. That's as good as it's gotten." Ventura gave him a tight professional grin in return.
"You'd rather be shooting it out with the Mexican drug dealers again?"
"No. But if they were all as exciting as this one, I'd have to start taking Viagra just to keep my attention up. This is going to be a cakewalk."
"You said that about the Mexicans at first."
The older man looked at him. "You expect things to warm?"
"Highly likely. Though probably not for a while yet. I'll keep you apprised."
Ventura drifted away, a man out for a late-night stroll, meandering toward the next station a couple hundred yards away. As he walked, he considered the client and the situation again. He had no problems with what the client was doing. That was his business and not Ventura's, save how it affected the job. Ventura didn't think much about morality. He had his own ethical system. When you had killed as many people as he had, the rules just didn't seem to apply to you in quite the same way as they did to normal people. He knew what sociopaths were, and he wasn't one. He had loved, had hated, had felt the usual emotions. He had been engaged once, but she had broken it off because she wasn't ready to settle down. He had fathered a child in South America, and though it had been 20 years ago, he still sent support to the woman and his daughter, whom he had seen several times secretly, but never officially met. There were a couple of people he had deleted that he'd felt sorry for and wished he hadn't had to do them, so he wasn't mentally disturbed or unstable. He had just gotten into a line of work that involved terminal violence, and had happened to be very good at it.
Of course, he had been in business long enough to realize that most governments operated with the same kind of amorality he did in many, if not most, areas. He had known intelligence officers who would look the other way and allowed whole villages of innocent civilians to be killed, because to do otherwise would have jeopardized some covert operation. He had known boy soldiers who had cranked up their assault rifles and hosed grandmothers and babies into bloody pulp for no other reason than because they had been having a real bad day. All of these people had convinced themselves they had been working for a greater good, that the end justified the means, that what they had done was, in fact, moral. Ventura did not try to fool himself that way. Protecting a man who had created some kind of mind-control device he wanted to sell to a foreign power for a lot of money was not much in the grand cosmic scheme of things. Ventura wasn't going to get any piece of the man's action, nor did he want it. He was hired to do a job, and he would do that. Money was not even a way to keep score. It didn't mean anything, especially if you had enough of it tucked away to live the rest of your life without ever lifting a finger. No. It was the personal challenge, the achievement of goals you set for yourself that mattered. When he was hired to kill somebody, he killed them. When he was hired to keep somebody alive, he kept them alive. Simple. Up here in the woods where he could command the lines of fire around his clients, keeping him alive would be fairly easy. Outright assassination wasn't likely, not yet, anyway. No, the worry would be kidnapping, torture, then execution. And it would be a lot harder to protect the man once they went back to civilization. Well, worry about that later. A man with his mind too far into tomorrow was more likely to get blindsided by somebody today. You had to consider the future, of course, but you didn't live there. Be in the moment. That was the way of it. Always.
Washington, D.C. Michaels could hardly believe it.
Tony, I'm glad to see you. Come in. Come in.
He reached for her bag.
I got it, she said.
Inside there was an awkward silence.
You want something to drink? Eat?
God, she looked great. It was all he could do to keep the baboon-like grin from taking over his face.
We need to talk, she said.
His stomach twisted.
Yes. Why did you lie to me?
I...
You said you slept with her.
Tony.
She says you didn't. Which is it, Alex? Did you have sex with Angela Cooper or not?
No.
Jesus Christ, Alex. What is the matter with you?
It's hard to explain.
Well, you are gonna explain it right here and right now.
He nodded and started to tell it. When he got to the end, she was shaking her head.
Why didn't you tell me that was what had happened?
He had had a lot of time to think about that, too much time.
Because I was ashamed. You turned down a gorgeous woman who wanted to jump your bones and you were ashamed?
I shouldn't have gone to supper with her. I shouldn't have had the beer, and I sure as hell shouldn't have gone to her apartment, shucked my clothes, and let her rub my back.
All true. Why did you?
He'd had time to think about that one, too.
You and I were having some problems. I was rattled about the whole British situation. I wasn't in control of work, of what was going on with us. There was all that crap about Megan and Susie and that private eye. Angela is an attractive, competent woman, and she was interested in me. I was flattered. I know none of it excuses what I did, but just so you know.
You're an idiot.
I know. It never should have come up.
So to speak, she said. She gave him a small grin and a great weight left him. But that's not what I meant. You're an idiot for not telling me.
When I saw you in the hotel lobby that morning, I didn't think you would believe me. You were certain I had done it, and you didn't want to talk about it, remember? You said you didn't want to hear another word.
She frowned, trying to remember.
Did I say that? It doesn't matter. The truth was,
I was lying naked on a table with a naked woman straddling me, and the desire was there.
But you didn't act on it.
The thought is as bad as the deed. She smiled again, shook her head. Not on my planet, it isn't.
You really are an idiot.
If they could hang us for thinking, we'd all be pushing up daisies.
You could have saved us both a lot of grief if you had just told me, Alex, even if I told you not to.
Yeah, well, I can see that now. She reached for his hands, took them in hers.
Come here.
Yes, ma'am. And just like that, Michael's life was very, very good again. Friday, June 10th, Anchorage, Alaska. They were in the airport waiting for the Alaska Airlines flight to SeaTac to board when Morrison's new phone cheeped. He froze for an instant. It was them. He looked at Ventura, then slipped the wireless headset on and adjusted the straw microphone. Yes? A crisp, accentless voice said,
Good morning.
I understand you have a used car for sale. Morrison's neck prickled with goose flesh. This was the phrase he had told them to use, and outside of the anonymous note he had posted into a security page run by the Chinese, nobody had been given the number of this particular phone, which he'd paid for in cash and registered under a phony name. He put his thumb over the mic.
It's the Chinese, he said to Ventura.
Ventura looked at his watch.
30 seconds, he said, pointing at the phone. No more. Follow me.
Morrison nodded and stood. He moved his thumb from the mic as Ventura pulled his own comm from his pocket and started talking into it quietly.
Yes, I have a car for sale.
I would like to see it. When can we get together?
Is your call number blocked?
No.
I'll call you back.
I look forward to it. Morrison thumbed the discom button on the belt phone. Ventura said,
My people have scammed the incoming number. We have it. Go in there and put the phone in the trash.
He pointed at the men's room.
Should I turn it off?
Leave it on. They probably already know where you are, but it'll give them something to look for. Morrison headed for the bathroom. Ventura waved, and a pair of college-aged men dressed in shorts and t-shirts and backpacks went into the men's room ahead of him. Ventura stayed out in the corridor. Morrison shoved the phone into the bin under the paper towel dispenser. When he exited, Ventura said,
There's a car waiting in front of the airport for us. Let's go.
You think they can get here that fast?
They can trace the phone from the carrier's SIG alone if you don't bounce it. Major National Intelligence Services have access to some very sophisticated equipment. They'll probably send somebody. It won't be a trio of long-fingernailed Chinese dressed in colorful Mandarin silks. More likely, it'll be a busty Norwegian blonde nurse helping a little old man with a cane hobble along. The last people you'd look at and think, Chinese intelligence. Certainly, they have local agents within a few minutes of most major cities. If you used a decent remailer, they won't backtrack your email for a while, though probably they'll get that soon. Morrison swallowed dryly. The service I used guaranteed confidentiality. Ventura smiled, looking like a human shark.
Sure, if somebody calls them on the phone and asks, they won't say anything. But confidentiality goes right out the window when somebody puts the point of a sharp knife into your remailer's back over his kidney and asks.
They'll know you're at the airport, but since the phone isn't in your name, they don't know who you are, so they'll look for the phone. When they find that, they'll look for single men traveling alone. You're under a pseudonym, ticketed as part of a group of 3 passengers, including 2 women, so they won't get that immediately.
With enough computing power, they can strain out all the flights leaving here today and check on every passenger.
Our phony IDs will hold up under a cursory scan, but if they can dig deep enough, they'll figure out they are fake eventually, though that won't really help them except to tell them we were going to Seattle and that we weren't on the plane. We could probably get to your house in Washington before they get who you are.
You are dealing with some serious people here, and it's never been a matter of if, but of when.
My wife is being watched by my people, and I've just sent more ops to back them up. She'll be safe, and we aren't going there.
Where are we going?
To a place where I can control access for the meeting.
We're going to drive there?
No. We're going to drive to a private airstrip and rent a plane. We want to be in the air as soon as we can.
Now that he had been put on alert, Morrison regarded the other people in the airport hallway with a newfound suspicion. Any one of them could be armed and out to collect him.
Frankly, I don't think they will scramble the A-team to grab you yet,
Ventura said as if reading his mind.
They know about the tests you did in their country, what the effect was on their villages, and they know you know about it, but they don't know for certain that you caused it. They'll have to check you out. Once they believe you, that's when we'll have to be extremely careful.
Morrison's mouth suddenly felt very dry indeed. He'd known this was coming, but it hadn't seemed so real before. The pit of his stomach felt like it did on a roller coaster. Well, there was nothing for it now. He was committed. This isn't quite what I expected.
It never is.
Friday, June 10th, Portland, Oregon. The Boomerang Championships were being held in Washington Park, which Tyrone thought was funny. They'd driven a couple thousand miles from Washington, D.C. to wind up in an Oregon park with the same name. It wasn't like any park in his neighborhood, though. The place was a giant sprawl that contained a lot of hills, tall evergreen trees, the Portland Zoo, plus a forestry center and some other stuff. Up and away from the zoo parking, they had carved a flat field out of one of the meadows, big enough for three or four soccer teams to play at the same time. The contest didn't start officially until tomorrow, and their event wasn't until Sunday, but there were 20 or so throwers out on the green practicing. The warm summer air was full of colorful twirling rings, blues and reds and oranges and greens, bright blurs looping back and forth. Tyrone turned to his father.
Okay?
His dad looked around, then nodded.
Looks safe enough. Mom and I'll be back in a couple of hours.
Tyrone nodded back, already thinking about practice. His dad had rented a car and left the RV parked back at the hotel. His parents wanted to go check out downtown Portland, but they didn't want to leave Tyrone and Nadine alone until they had checked out the park. Given the numbers of families with small children, the lack of gang colors or guys throwing beer bottles at each other, Dad had decided that Tyrone and Nadine were probably safe enough here in the middle of the afternoon.
You have your credit card?
Yep.
You got your phone?
Yes, Dad.
It's on?
Tyrone rolled his gaze toward the heavens. He pulled the little phone from his belt and held it up so his father could see the display.
Yes, Dad.
What, did they think he was still a baby? This was Portland, not Baltimore. Nadine started unpacking her rings.
Go already, parental units. We're fine here.
His mom smiled. Once they were gone, Tyrone and Nadine looked for a place to get started. There were circles drawn on the grass, but most of these were already taken. That didn't matter. They had washaway chalk. They could make their own circle.
Hey, scope it. Isn't that Jerry Prince?
He pointed. She looked.
I think so.
Best MTA guy in the world. The International's winner last year and the world record holder. Word was, he threw 8 minutes in practice on slackwind days and had a witnessed but unofficial 14-minute flight.
Let's watch him. Maybe we'll learn something.
She laughed. You will, for sure.
I got style already. You got mouth, is what you got. I'm going to be pushing 3 minutes here.
He waved his stopwatch at her.
You're pushing a dumpster full of horse pucky is what you are pushing. You are probably going to trip and fall into it.
He laughed. She was funny. Washington, D.C. Michaels might have felt better a few times in his life. His wedding night, the day his daughter was born, even the first time he and Tony had been together in this very bed, but this had to rank right up there with the best. Tony was back, and the two of them were naked under the sheets. That went a long way to smooth the turbulent waters he had been in lately.
What time is it?
She asked, sleep still thick in her voice.
8.
You're late for work.
I called in sick.
She grinned.
I have to pee.
Go ahead, I'll make the coffee. Meet you back here in a few minutes.
He had already started the coffee and was able to snatch a couple of cups and be back in bed before Tony returned from the bathroom.
That was fast, she said, taking one of the heavy china mugs. She inhaled the vapor.
So you want to talk some more about how stupid I am?
You'd have to call in sick for a few more days to exhaust that one.
Okay. How about, what now?
We could take a shower together.
She smiled over the top of the mug.
Oh, yeah, but I meant something a little further ahead.
We could come back to bed after the shower.
Tony.
I know. I know. Let's just let everything else wait, okay?